7 states will decide this year's presidential election. So does that mean the votes in those states count more than yours? And why is that? In 2016, Hillary Clinton won nearly 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but she lost the presidential election because of fewer than 80,000 votes in 3 states. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's the Electoral College that matters in presidential races, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Joining me in this recorded interview are Bowling Green State University political science professor and author of Representation and the Electoral College, Robert Alexander. Welcome back to the program, Rob.
It's good to be back.
And member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the book, Let the People Pick the President, Jesse Wegman. Thanks for being here, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse, let's go back to the presidential election of 2016. Your book starts with a behind-the-scenes look at how the Electoral College played out in that race and the faithless electors, including Michael Baca. Tell us what a faithless elector is and briefly tell us what unfolded after that election.
Right. So for those who don't remember, it was quite a dramatic few weeks after Donald Trump appeared to have won enough electoral votes to become president. A group of electors, they called themselves Hamilton electors, and I can explain why in just a second, got together and basically came up with this scheme to award their electors to a different candidate, not to Donald Trump or to Hillary Clinton, but to a third candidate such as John Kasich, who is a Republican candidate who had dropped out pretty early that year. The idea was if they could prevent Donald Trump from reaching the magic number of 270 electoral votes, they could prevent him from winning the White House. Now, you know, the whole scheme is based on this notion that the electors are free agents, essentially, are people who, as the founders originally thought, would be chosen for their, you know, their heightened level of intelligence and sensitivity to political affairs and their wisdom about what a democracy needs in terms of its leaders, and that they would make these choices sort of independently. Of course, that has not been the way the Electoral College has functioned for more than 200 years. It actually only worked that way in the first two elections, both of which led to the election of George Washington. Ever since then, the Electoral College, the electors, I should say, have done essentially the same thing, which is they've played the role of, they've been team players. They've either been the Democrats or they've been the Republicans or whichever parties were ascendant at the time. And so this whole notion that the people who are trying to stop Donald Trump from getting into the White House by using this outmoded method of their electoral vote power was completely against the way that the Electoral College actually works. It was kind of laughable, actually, and those of us who were watching it play out in real time were just shaking our heads and saying, this is not the way to do it. The reason they call themselves Hamilton electors was they were referring to one of the Federalist Papers in which Alexander Hamilton explained that electors were supposed to be these, you know, careful, deliberative, thoughtful men. And in fact, it's just not how it works. So Michael Baca and several of his allies tried to do this. They enlisted the support of people all over the country. They got celebrities on board. They got, you know, people contributing to their GoFundMe campaigns, all of this. And in the end, the whole thing collapsed, and it was completely predictable from the beginning because electors just don't, certainly they didn't have enough electors to make this switch. I think they needed in the order of many dozens, and they only had a few. But, you know, it's just electors don't do that. Electors want to vote for their candidate, and they all did, virtually all did that in 2016, as they do every year.
And Rob, 2000, that presidential race between George W. Bush and Al Gore was another example of an election where the losing candidate won the popular vote.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States. And I promised him that I wouldn't call him back this time.
This, of course, happened again in 2016, as I referenced earlier, with Hillary Clinton.
We must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it.
Rob, in your book, you call these misfire elections. How often have these misfire elections happened in U.S. history?
Where we have a popular vote winner that doesn't win the Electoral College. I borrowed that term from some other scholars, Longley and Pierce, that called them misfire elections. Sometimes when you write about a misfire election, others who are defenders of the Electoral College will say, no, the Electoral College acted as it was intended to act. It's not a misfire. But most Americans, you know, they look at that and they say, well, it deviated from the popular electoral vote. That's some kind of a misfire. It's actually happened five times in American history, which is essentially 10% of presidential elections have ended in a misfire. And you might even count the 1960 election as a sixth election where there was a misfire election. So they've happened in 1824. And in that case, Andrew Jackson won the popular vote and the Electoral College vote, but he didn't win the Electoral College vote by a majority. And he lost the presidency in the House of Representatives through a contingent election. It happened in 1876. In that race, it was a true debacle. There were electoral slates that were contested. So it was a contested election, kind of in many ways similar to what folks were calling for in the 2020 election. You had these multiple electoral slates that were sent to Congress. There was no real means to determine who was the rightful winner. A commission was hastily created. When the commission's composition was known, which actually favored the goose was cooked, so to speak. The Electoral Count Reform Act was created about a decade after that election as a means to resolve disputed elections. It came into play in that 2000 election, also in 2016, and then again in 2020. So it has been used seldom, but then the events of 2020 caused a wholesale reform of that act. So then we had the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022 to resolve disputed votes, which hopefully will not come into play in this upcoming election. But it's worth noting that that came about through a bipartisan fashion in response to January 6th and the events that occurred there, and was not on the radar of Congress for 135 years prior.
Jesse, explain briefly how we ended up with the Electoral College. You write that in the words of one constitutional scholar, it was kind of a Frankenstein compromise.
Yes, you know, the Electoral College at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 was really one of the hardest things, if not the hardest thing, that the framers of the Constitution had to come up with. So remember, the reason that they were building a constitution in the first place was because the first attempt at a national charter, the Articles of Confederation, was rapidly showing its weaknesses. The country was falling apart. And one of the major weaknesses of that original system was the lack of a chief executive, the lack of a president. And so one of the first things they do at the beginning of the convention is they establish the office of a president. And then they start to debate, well, what kind of powers is this person going to have? They actually debated whether it would even be a single person. There were people at the convention who wanted a panel, as some of the states used for their own executives. But once they decided on a single person, the questions became, what powers will that person hold and how will the person be chosen? You had top delegates like James Wilson of Pennsylvania calling for a popular vote. You had other delegates calling for Congress to choose the president. You had other delegates calling for governors to choose the president. You had other delegates calling for state legislatures to choose the president. So in short, this was a massively complicated debate that tied into all the other debates at the convention, and no one could settle on a choice that everyone felt, or at least even a majority of the delegates, which is how they voted, felt comfortable with. And so this gets pushed off and pushed off and pushed off over the course of the summer. And it wasn't until the closing days of the convention in the second week of September that a small group of delegates that are known informally as the Committee on Unfinished Parts meets together in a side room of Independence Hall, what was then the Pennsylvania State House, and basically cobble together the system for electing the president that we now call the Electoral College. It was the longest single provision in the Constitution, incredibly convoluted, and they did it basically just to get out the door and send the Constitution off to the states for ratification. It very quickly became clear that this was not a good system. James Madison, another of the top founders, who himself had at one point during the convention said he favored a popular vote for president, later in a letter to one of his friends said, basically admitted, yeah, the system we used for choosing the president was the product of haste and impatience, and everyone was tired. We all wanted to get out of there, and the results are obvious in the design of the system. It collapsed almost immediately, or I should say the design of it stopped working as the framers thought it would. Almost immediately, within a decade of the Constitution's adoption, you had the election of 1800, which was the first what's called contingent election in American history. The election gets thrown into the House of Representatives because the Electoral College didn't work the way the founders thought, and or many of them thought. And the House of Representatives has an extremely chaotic and tense several days where they vote, I think, 36 times before Thomas Jefferson eventually wins. So the system that was adopted, as I said earlier, was adopted by people who thought that most Americans just wouldn't know enough about national political candidates to make an informed choice. And that was why they chose a system that sort of, you know, created these proxies, these people who were by general acclaim known to have a much sort of more information about national candidates and could make a choice that would serve the country. Of course, it didn't turn out to work that way. National political parties developed in that decade after the Constitution was adopted, and national political parties were not on the radar of the framers. They did not write a constitution with the awareness that these parties would develop. So as soon as the parties develop, the whole system collapses, and we have the sort of the bizarre team sport element of it that we see today.
We're talking in this recorded interview about the Electoral College, its origins, how it works, and whether we should keep it. Rob, how did slavery in the Three-Fifths Compromise play into the Electoral College?
I've come on the side that while it wasn't first and foremost, they didn't really talk about it per se in the discussion of the Electoral College, it was implicit in this, Jesse referred to it as convoluted system. To kind of say, you know, we're going to take this House representation, which is going to be based upon population, and Senate representation, which is going to be based upon statehood. That Senate representation was really, really key, certainly for less populated states, but also slaveholding states, because recall that, you know, at the outset of the Constitution, the Three-Fifths Compromise recognized slaves not as a full person, but as three-fifths of a person. So that representation that they were afforded in the Senate just from simply being a state helped less populated states, but also slaveholding states acquire more power under that federal form of representation. That then just, I think, fit nicely in that framework that Committee of Unfinished Parts put together to say, well, this will kind of guide our process in the Electoral College. And so while not necessarily explicit, it implicitly had a part to play in this creation of the Electoral College that we see today.
Jesse, this legacy from slavery seems to have persisted in the Electoral College when it comes to representation. You wrote that with winner-take-all rules, Black voters essentially had no political representation in the 1960s. In 1968, nearly 600,000 Black voters in the South picked Hubert Humphrey, but in the Electoral College, all those votes were converted into votes for the Alabama governor and segregationist George Wallace. And in the words of a 1979 report that you quote, it was as if they had never voted, end quote. Talk to us just a little bit about this winner-take-all system and the impacts it has.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And winner-take-all in the Electoral College really is the nub of the whole thing. And it's going to be really important for listeners here and for Americans everywhere to understand that it's when we talk about the Electoral College, we're really talking about this winner-take-all system. I'd like to just make one observation to, I think, Robert's very good summary of the role of slavery, which is a complex one at the convention as it pertained to the presidency. But he said that this was largely implicit. I think that's generally true, although there are a few very, I think, quite notable examples where it was explicit. James Madison at several points. You know, James Madison, a lot of people consider to be the father of the Constitution. I think he, you know, there were a number of people at the convention who were equally important, but Madison is no doubt one of the top delegates there. And Madison says at several points, as does Alexander Hamilton, the main dividing line here is not between big states and small states. It is between slaveholding states and non-slaveholding states. He says this openly. This is not a secret. It's not something we're making up 240 years later. They were very open about the fact that there was a big fight over slavery, and that fight ran through every major debate at the convention. I'm just going to read you this one quote from late July as they return again to this question of how to choose the president. Madison says, as I mentioned earlier, Madison says he thought that a direct popular vote for president was the fittest in itself, meaning he thought that was his preference. And he thought it would be as likely as any other method to produce an executive of, quote, distinguished character. But then Madison gives this caveat. He says there is one difficulty of a serious nature regarding a popular vote. And then he says the right of suffrage, the right to vote, was much more diffusive in the northern than the southern states, and the latter could have no influence in the election on the score of the Negroes. The substitution of electors obviated this difficulty and seemed on the whole to be liable to fewest objections. So what Madison is saying there very, very explicitly is that if a popular vote were the method of choosing the president, these southern states that have populations, slave populations that are 40, sometimes up to 50% of the people who live there, suddenly lose a lot of influence in the choosing of the president because their slaves don't have the right to vote, right? They don't have any human rights. So it was an acknowledgement by James Madison and by many others at the convention that this issue of slavery was central to the question of how to choose the president. That said, I'll answer your question about winner take all, which is, you know, this is the method that all but two states have chosen to award their electors. And through most of American history, winner take all has been the main method. There's one point that I think everyone should understand, which is this is a state decision. The federal constitution says nothing about how states should award their electors. They say that the constitution gives states electors, right? That they have a set number that each state gets, which is equal to its two senators plus its House representation. Beyond that, the constitution says you do it how you want. You award the electors how you want. If you want your state legislature to do it without any regard to what the voters of the state want, they can do that. If you want to do it by popular vote, you could do that. If you want the governor to choose based on what he had for breakfast that morning, he could do that. But all but two states, Maine and Nebraska, today have chosen winner take all. And what that means is, and Ohio is one of those, of course, what that means is the candidate who wins a plurality of the vote in the state, that means the most votes, not necessarily a majority, wins all 100% of the state's electors. And that's why I said in my book, and that's why I quote the example of the black voters in the South in the late 60s, everyone who doesn't vote for the candidate who gets the most votes is effectively erased before the actual vote for president happens, which is in mid-December when the Electoral College meets and the electors cast their ballots. And that's what's so, I think, corrosive and distorting about the Electoral College, is that you're having these mini elections in the states and erasing tens of millions of Americans, Democrats in what we call red states, Republicans in blue states, who end up essentially giving their votes to the winner of the statewide election. And I think that's what I think offends people. That's why we call this a misfire. As Robert said, you know, some people get their backs up at that term, but all it reflects is a natural inclination toward majority rule. Majority rule is the way that we run every election in this country, except for the presidential election, where we have these 51 with DC, separate elections that are held, and then that get to award the electors from the results of those elections in this winner-take-all fashion. And that's why you have popular vote losing presidents. That's why you have presidents who can win a minority of the vote, win less than their opponent, and still become president. It's because of that winner-take-all rule. And that's the rule that I think is what people should focus on when we're talking about Electoral College reform.
We'll continue our conversation about the Electoral College after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our recorded conversation about the Electoral College. My guests are member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the book Let the People Pick the President, Jesse Wegman, and Bowling Green State University political science professor and author of Representation in the Electoral College, Robert Alexander. Rob, that winner-takes-all system is not in the Constitution. Do you have a sense for whether the framers of the Constitution anticipated a system like that? I mean, we just talked about before the break what a huge impact that has.
Well, I don't think that the framers anticipated the Electoral College that we have today. And let me just kind of just make this point that when people talk about the framers and the Electoral College, you have to really determine what framers we're talking about and what Electoral College we're talking about. I think Jesse pointed out earlier that, you know, there were times during the convention that the framers were at odds with themselves. So at some points they wanted a direct popular vote, and other points they didn't. So there was some confusion there. They were always looking for consensus, not necessarily the best form of means to select the president, but one that everybody could agree with. So this version of the Electoral College ended with the adoption of the 12th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution after the crisis election of 1800 that Jesse spoke about a little bit ago. And so that really kind of shored up and really cemented the idea of the winner-take-all and the two-party system. The framers were political animals. I mean, you know, initially George Mason's talking about, the Electoral College will really be a nominating body and Congress will make that decision 19 times out of 20. Well, very quickly, they realized that running these party tickets would be the means to acquire power for those two emerging political parties. And the best means to do that then would be through that winner-take-all process. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen so much reluctance from states across the country to do anything other than the winner-take-all system, because they are concerned that they might invite third parties to have a little bit more power and influence in their presidential elections, and they don't want that. So, it's a feature that the framers, I don't think, were thinking about. And again, really, the Electoral College that we have today is not the Electoral College that came out of Philadelphia in the late 1780s.
And there have been hundreds of attempts to reform or abolish the Electoral College. Jesse, the closest the Electoral College ever came to being abolished was in the 1960s. Tell us about Birch Bayh and his efforts.
Sure. As you say, I think we're over 800 separate attempts in Congress to either amend or abolish the Electoral College by now, which is far more than for any other single provision of the Constitution. Why is that? Why are we struggling so much with this one provision so many hundreds of years later? And I think it goes back to something I was saying earlier, which is that fundamental instinctive sense that people have that majority rule is the right way to decide elections. And I really think that's at the key here. And I want to make this as a normative argument, which is that, you know, a lot of people argue about what's the point of the Electoral College and what does the Electoral College actually do. There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of myths. But the bottom line is every election that we hold, we run by winner take all. This is the only one where a candidate can lose the vote and win the election. And I think that offends people, because majority rule is the essence of how we run government. It's the heart of how representative democracy functions. And so Birch Bayh, you know, in the 1960s, he's this relatively junior senator from Indiana, and he sees this. He says, and it's been, 80 years at that point since there had been one of these misfires. It was 1888 was the last time. So almost no one living had even experienced one. And yet it was so clear. And the reason it was so clear that this was an unfair way to choose the president was because the country had just been going through the sort of upheaval and the revolution of the civil rights movement. And what that movement, you know, I think inculcated more than anything else was the idea of one person, one vote, what we call political equality, right? This idea that no matter where you live, your vote counts the same. But then you have, in 1968, you have this election that really completely upends everybody's expectations for how American elections run. And that is with George Wallace, who's the former Alabama governor and segregationist, running on an explicitly segregationist ticket and trying to draw enough electoral votes away from the two major party candidates to throw the election back into the House, the scenario that Robert was just describing that happened in 1800 and again in 1824. He didn't succeed in doing this. Wallace failed, though he did win five states in the Deep South, and he won, I think, around 45 or 50 electoral votes from them. He didn't succeed in throwing the election into the House, but just getting as close as he did, I think, alarmed huge numbers of Americans and made them realize, oh, wait a minute, this system that we have for electing the president doesn't make any sense. And it allows all kinds of shenanigans to happen.
We're living in troubled times. We're living in a dangerous world where the stability of the United States of America is really the most important thing facing us. It's extremely important that when the president of the United States is elected, we know with confidence that he is the president of the United States, and not only that the people of the world look to him as the president of the United States, but of greater significance that the people of this country have faith in him as their leader. And when we have an electoral college system which threatens to elect a man who has fewer votes than his opponent, we tend to erode the confidence in the people of this country, in their president, and in their form of government.
So Birch Bayh is riding the momentum of all these sort of cultural and political transformations and events. And he says, he comes out after holding months of hearings in the Senate, he comes out and says, we need a popular vote for president. We need to dismantle the Electoral College and replace it with a popular vote for president. There's an incredible push behind this. There's incredible support for it. You would never believe it today, given how polarized the country feels and how divided we all seem on so many issues. But in fact, 80% of Americans, according to polls in the late 1960s, supported a popular vote for president. 80%. I can't think of any issue today that commands such consensus. It passed the House of Representatives. A constitutional amendment to eliminate the Electoral College passed the House of Representatives in 1969 with 80% of the vote. And that vote came from representatives from small states, from large states, from states on the coast, from states in the heartland. Everywhere across the country, lawmakers were in favor of switching to the popular vote. And it looked like you had enough support in the states to ratify such an amendment. The amendment fails in September of 1970. It doesn't get a vote in the Senate. It gets filibustered in the Senate. And that filibuster was led by three Southern senators, all of them, I would say not coincidentally, the descendants of slaveholders, Strom Thurmond, Sam Ervin, and Jim Eastland. And they successfully filibustered the Electoral College Amendment until it died on the floor. And it never got its vote in the Senate, and it never went out to the states for ratification. We have not, since that time, September of 1970, come anywhere near as close to switching to a popular vote. But just imagine how different the country would be now if we had. And so that story is such an amazing one of how much political change is possible that people don't realize, and how recently in our own history, major change has come. We've come right to the doorstep of really transformational change.
Well, some of these arguments for keeping the Electoral College revolve around perceptions or misperceptions that the popular vote would allow big cities and states to dominate every election, that the Electoral College gives the little guy a voice. Jesse, what should we know about the reality there?
I mean, it's just not true. I don't mean to be too blunt here, but they're not true. The major defenses of the Electoral College, almost every single one that I can think of, are just based on misunderstandings of how the Electoral College works, misunderstandings of how people vote or how many people live in cities versus non-cities, misunderstandings of the history and the adoption of the college, as we've been discussing. But specifically to the point of it would, without the Electoral College, we'd always be dominated by the you know, take your pick, the big states, the big cities, the coastal cities, the New Yorks and the LAs and the San Franciscos. It's just not true. You can look at this as just a simple matter of statistics. The biggest cities in the country actually add up to a far smaller percentage of the overall popular vote than people realize. People drastically overestimate and have for many decades the size of the cities. Some of this in the 1950s and 60s, when you heard that, it carried an extremely racialized tone to it. You know, people would be saying effectively that we don't want these cities to have so much power because these are the sort of the more ethnically and racially diverse parts of the country. And you do still hear that today in some circles. But the bottom line is, it's not true. The cities don't have that kind of power. Cities can't even control elections within their own states. You know, we've had Republican governors of both New York and California in the last few decades. Obviously, Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York City do not choose Republicans by large numbers. So, you know, if they can't even control the executive in their own state, they can't control the outcome of an election that in the whole country. It's actually, you can look at it another way, which is, what percentage of Americans live in urban areas versus suburban areas versus exurban and small towns, that outer ring there, and then in rural areas. And when you break it down that way, it's actually amazing to see you have almost equal proportions of Americans in those four categories, roughly 25%, give or take a percent or two, in each of those four categories. So one way of interpreting that is, the cities, the big cities in America, the urban areas, are offset exactly the rural areas of the country. And the election is decided by that middle 50%, because the cities vote roughly 60-40 in favor of Democrats. The rural areas vote roughly 60-40 in favor of Republicans. It's kind of a wash. So there's just this vast misunderstanding about how numbers actually work in this country and how populations that actually vote. And that leads to this, I think, really mistaken defense of the college. Nobody actually wins in the Electoral College right now, except for the seven states that you mentioned at the top of your program, these battleground states. Those are the states that get all the attention, all of the focus from the candidates, all of the ads, all of the campaign dollars. Everything goes into those seven states, and all the other states, small, large, coastal, central, they all get ignored under the system we live with right now.
Rob, another myth, you know, Jesse was talking about this, the idea that the Electoral College forces candidates to campaign all over the country. But is that really true? I mean, it seems like for the last few weeks, all we've been hearing about is a few key states, Pennsylvania, Georgia. What does that tell us about how the Electoral College really works in reality?
Let me kind of, again, backtrack to the framers. One of the things that they were really concerned about was that they did not want favorite sons to be the president of the United States. What they wanted was somebody who would be a national figure. They thought that they wanted somebody to kind of look out for the entire country. And what we're seeing today, of course, is a battle to be the president of the swing states of America. That's where they're spending all of their time. In the last several elections, 90%+ of all campaigning is taking place in 10 states or less. 75% is taking place in 6 to 7 states. That's where they're spending all of their time and attention and money in the end of the campaign. Along with that, you think about all of those less populated states. They're not getting any love whatsoever from a presidential campaign. Moreover, you know, if you kind of really step back and think about it, California has the fifth largest GDP, if it were a country, in the world, and they will get no attention in a presidential campaign. They also have a very strong agricultural economy. So those questions about, well, it's about cities versus rural, I mean, you find that in large states, you find that in less populated states. So some of those arguments, they just fall apart when you actually look at it. And the candidates are only spending their time in those battleground states. If those battleground states, so that we've talked about the racial dimension, if they look like the rest of the country, maybe that's an efficient way to run a campaign, if that's what you wanted to say about it. But they typically don't look like the rest of the country. So those blue wall states that Kamala Harris is really focusing her attention on, Donald Trump really surprised people on back in 2016, they tend to be whiter, they tend to be older, they tend to be less educated. And so if they, do they look like the rest of the country? Not necessarily. So there could be some additional concerns or dimensions to think about when we're thinking about a national campaign, which doesn't really play out then in these presidential campaigns.
We'll continue our conversation after another short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our recorded conversation about the Electoral College. My guests are a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the book, Let the People Pick the President, Jesse Wegman, and Bowling Green State University political science professor and author of Representation and the Electoral College, Robert Alexander. Let's go briefly back to the elections of the past few decades, some of which have ended up in the courts. We could see another election in the coming days in which the Electoral College winner does not win the popular vote. This time it could be the Democratic candidate, and Donald Trump is making every effort to get out the vote.
So get everyone you know and vote. We want a landslide that's too big to rig, okay? Too big to rig.
We also could have a tie in the Electoral College, in which case it would go to the House of Representatives to decide the election. I want to ask you both about your thoughts on this. Rob, I'll start with you. Do you think we could end up with a misfire election or a tie?
Well, I think that Donald Trump's most likely path to the presidency would indeed be a misfire election where he would lose the popular vote but win in the Electoral College. So I think that that's something folks should prepare for if Trump were to win. There is an outside, in fact, forecasters at 538 are saying that there's a 1 in 5 chance that that will happen. And then if we take a look at Kamala Harris, there's a slim chance, a non-zero chance, that Donald Trump could possibly win the popular vote but lose in the Electoral College. Very unlikely, but that could happen. You know, the idea of a tie in the Electoral College, that would come down to that winner-take-all system. We have 538, so you know, an even number can be divided into half, right? And Nebraska has a district election. There's one competitive district there. If that were to, if everything were equal and Kamala Harris were to win those blue wall states equal to the 2020 election, she wins those blue wall states but loses several of those Sun Belt states, then that one congressional district in Omaha would be critical. Because it would come down to that congressional district. If Trump were to win it, he would have 269 electoral votes to 269. If she wins it, then she wins with 270 electoral college votes. So a very close election in the electoral college is certainly a possibility. And the relationship to the popular vote is certainly one that, you know, decades ago, we would have been paying, it seems like, so much more attention to in the crisis of legitimacy. And I'll just say something about that very quickly, that those presidents that have come into power through these misfire elections have not been judged well by historians. They all end up on the bottom half in historians' viewpoints, in part because they come into power through a misfire election in a crisis of legitimacy right from the get-go.
Jesse, how does the Stop the Steal movement, how is that made possible by the Electoral College?
I mean, you know, this is what I think people are slowly coming to see, which is that the January 6th insurrection was directly related to the manner in which we choose the president. You know, remember in 2020, Joe Biden won more than 7 million more votes among the people than Donald Trump did. And yet, you know, it was close enough in enough states that a few tens of thousands of votes switching would have altered the outcome. But that 7 million was not in dispute, right? That, like, there was no question that was going to be his margin, or the margin quickly, you know, became clear over the days and weeks after as all the votes came in. But instead, we have this system that drags the process out. There's There's, you know, the state counts lead to certifications. The certifications get sent to Congress. Congress then opens the ballots and reads them. And that's what happened on January 6th. And all of that opens the door for these kinds of machinations by people like Trump and his allies in 2020. And you know, they're promising to do this again. They've already started the process. You know, they've already started saying there's cheating going on in Pennsylvania. They don't have evidence for this. They didn't have any evidence for it in 2020. They don't have any evidence for it now. But just the fact that there are so many stops on the way to determining who our president is, you know, opens the door and creates opportunities. And of course, social media now, you know, amplifies so many of these lies and stories that are not grounded in any kind of observable reality. So millions of Americans come to think, oh, the election was stolen. But in fact, you know, elections are run extraordinarily well for a country of our size. They are decentralized. It's our system of federalism allows for the elections to be run at the local and state levels. And, it, you know, it's fraud and error are extremely small given how many people vote. And it's never come close to being enough to alter the outcome of the election. So I really think, you know, the Stop the Steal movement and that kind of you know, the sort of dishonest and bad faith efforts of the lawyers, especially involved in that, is directly related to the process we use for choosing the president.
Jesse, we talked before about how it would take a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College. Tell us about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact and how that could maybe achieve the same thing without having to amend the Constitution.
Sure. So, you know, we've been talking about this winner-take-all rule and how that's up to the states. It's up to the states to choose how to award their electors. So, you know, as several people have pointed out, and as a computer scientist in California named John Koza operationalized about 20 years ago, if states can choose how to award their electors, why do they have to do winner-take-all on a state-by-state basis? Why not award their electors according to who wins the most votes in the entire country? So that was the kind of the seed of the clever idea that led to this compact. And, you know, an interstate compact is just an agreement among states to do something. There's hundreds in effect today. And the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact has two central components that are tied to each other. One is it does not take effect until states representing 270 electoral votes join it. We know 270 is that magic number we've been talking about. That's the number of electoral votes you need to be elected president. The other element is that the states that join it agree to award all of their electors, not to the candidate who wins the most votes in their state, as they currently do, but to the candidate who wins the most votes nationally. You put one and two together, those two components of this compact, and you guarantee that the candidate who wins the most votes in the country becomes the president. And the reason that's so important is that it forces the candidates to actually care about the whole country. Rob said earlier that the candidates now compete to be the president of the battleground states. And that's not a good way to run a representative democracy. The president is responsible for everybody who lives everywhere. You want the president to care about Americans no matter where they live. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is aimed at that goal. It's aimed at forcing the candidates from both major parties to care about voters everywhere. I think there's around 17 states that have joined now. So they're at around, last I checked, they were in the 210 electoral vote range in terms of how many states have joined. So they're roughly 60 electoral votes away from this compact taking effect and really transforming again the way that we choose the president.
We're recording this before Election Day. Rob, how likely do you think it is that the winner of the popular vote for president will be different this year than the winner of the Electoral College?
One other point about the Electoral College is the math piece of it. Because of that winner-take-all selection process, for most of American history, the winner of the Electoral College, their victory has been amplified because of that. So in a close election, so for instance, Bill Clinton in 1992 gets 43% of the popular vote, but 68% of the Electoral College vote. So the point that I'm getting at here is that we may very well have a very close presidential election at the national level, speaking about the popular vote. But it could be a blowout in the Electoral College. We could have one of those candidates winning 320, 330 Electoral College votes. That's very possible. I think, in fact, that might be more likely than the scenarios that, you know, where it's a tie in the Electoral College or it's what right at 270. I think part of what we're seeing right now is our recent history. You know, we just did a public opinion poll of Ohioans. They're scared to death. They're very nervous about state legislatures and, you know, interfering in the Electoral College, about dual slates being offered, about Congress interfering. You know, they don't like any of that kind of stuff. So I think we're playing with that recent history in our minds. But, you know, the reality is that most presidential elections are razor thin in the national popular vote. But they're not that different when it comes to, or excuse me, very different when it comes to the Electoral College vote. So typically we see blowouts, not really, really close ones.
What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, I'd like to push back on that a little bit. You know, I wrote a piece about this for the paper a few weeks ago. In the 21st century alone, the average popular vote margin between the two candidates has been 4.6 million votes. You know, that's not, I would not call that razor thin. What I would call razor thin is the outcomes in a few determinative swing states. And as we've seen, obviously, in Florida, as Rob was saying, in 2,538 votes, in, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania in 2016, and again in 2020 with Georgia and Arizona, you're talking about a matter of thousands or just a couple, you know, 10,000 votes. Those are razor thin results. But at the national level, if we were talking about a popular vote being the way to run an election, it's extraordinarily unlikely for an election to be that close with that many people voting. So 4.6 million votes, that's a lot of votes. You know, as we discussed, Joe Biden won by significantly more than that, over 7 million. And so at some point, you just have to ask, what is enough of an expression of majority rule to translate into how the American people get to pick their leader? And right now, a majority of Americans could well pick Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. I think that's the far more likely outcome. And yet Donald Trump could still become president. I don't think a representative democracy can survive long when it continues to reject the majority preferences of the people.
I've been talking with Bowling Green State University political science professor and author of Representation and the Electoral College, Robert Alexander, and member of the New York Times editorial board and author of the book Let the People Pick the President, Jesse Wegman. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.